Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. The former president of Afghanistan, Burhanuddin Rabbani, has been assassinated in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Police say an attacker claiming to be a Taliban negotiator detonated explosives in his turban, killing Professor Rabbani, who's the chairman of Afghanistan's High Peace Council. Afghanistan's president, Hamid Karzai, has condemned the assassination. Correspondent Sally Sara reports from the site of the killing in Kabul.
This time, the insurgents have not only hit a high-profile political figure, but also the peace process itself. Burhanuddin Rabbani was a former president of Afghanistan. Last year, he was appointed as the chairman of the newly formed High Peace Council. Professor Rabbani was given the dangerous and difficult job of guiding the negotiations between the government and its opponents, including the Taliban. Senior security official General Haladin Halal says two men claiming to have a message from the Taliban arranged a meeting at Professor Rabbani's house. Police say one of the attackers detonated explosives hidden in his turban, killing the former Afghan president. Professor Rabbani's close friend and political ally, Faisaluddin Amak, has praised the Peace Council chairman and condemned those responsible for his death. Burhanuddin Rabbani's supporters regarded him as a wise scholar, but his critics accused him of human rights abuses. News of his death reached President Hamid Karzai at the United Nations in New York just before he held talks with his counterpart Barack Obama. Both leaders expressed their sadness and resolve.
It is a tragic loss. We want to extend our heartfelt condolences to you, his family, and the people of Afghanistan. Despite this incident, we will not be deterred from creating a path whereby Afghans can live in freedom, in safety, and security and prosperity.
It was among the few people in Afghanistan with the distinction that we cannot easily find in societies. A terrible loss, but as you rightly said, this would not deter us from continuing on the path that we have.
But the attackers raise renewed questions about the security of the Afghan capital.
Well, a week ago, the insurgents struck a building next to the US embassy and also the compound of the International Security Assistance Force. They were able to get up high in that building and fire down. This time, they've struck Mr. Rabbani's compound, which is just at the rear of the US embassy. This is a worrying sign for security forces that the insurgents have yet again been able to get into this district to be able to bring in...
Suddenly, journalists and bystanders start running from the scene. There are fears police are about to start shooting.
Keep walking. Keep moving. Keep moving, sir.
The police are pointing their weapons at each other, arguing over who's in control. It's a small measure of the level of tension and confusion. Security forces are bracing for further insurgent attacks in the capital. This is Sally Sara in Kabul for AM.
The International Monetary Fund has warned that the global economy is entering a dangerous new phase, with the world's biggest economies on the verge of a double-dip recession. In its biannual outlook, the IMF says a fragile economic recovery could be jeopardised by failed efforts to cut debt around the globe. The fund has trimmed Australia's growth forecasts to below budget and treasury forecasts, but says Australia is well placed to weather the global turmoil. The fund's chief economist singles out Europe as a major source of worry. With more, here's correspondent Emma Alberici.
The IMF's world economic outlook makes for grim reading. Growth in the developed world is weak, anemic. Prospects for the United States have been revised down to 1.5%. The UK is now likely to grow just 1.1% this year. Europe and the US could slip back into recession next year unless they attack economic problems quickly before they infect the rest of the world. The IMF, which has been involved in bailing out Greece, Ireland and Portugal, now believes the global economy is at a tipping point. Chief economist Olivier Blanchard.
The global economy has entered a dangerous new phase. The recovery has weakened considerably. Strong policies are needed both to improve the outlook and to reduce the risks.
With continuing indecision about how to save Greece, Europe remains the biggest concern. The IMF urged the European Central Bank to lower interest rates if risks to growth persist. It's asked Britain to reconsider its tough austerity measures if they push the country into recession. But Foreign Secretary William Hague says there is no plan B.
We have the discipline and the determination to putting right the huge deficits and debt that we were left by the last government, and we will go on with absolute determination doing that and no wavering in that whatsoever.
La scure di standard è pur se stata inesorabile.
The IMF report came as Italians woke to the news that their country's debt rating was downgraded by Standard & Poor's from A+ to A, making it harder for Italy to borrow money and putting more pressure on the euro. Italy is the eurozone's third biggest economy. At around six times the size of the Greek economy, it's considered too big to bail out. The Italian Prime Minister dismissed the downgrade as a political stunt, but analyst Phil Tyson of MF Global disagrees.
Exactly. I think what's becoming apparent is this sort of ad hoc approach by the European policymakers of loading fiscal austerity onto these peripheral economies. It is simply not working, because what it's doing is it's driving down growth and creating more of a problem.
The IMF cut its growth forecast for the 17-nation eurozone to 1.6% in 2011. At the moment, the single currency bloc is barely growing at an annual rate of 0.25%. The fund cautioned that hasty budget cuts in the US could further weaken growth. Among the major advanced economies, the IMF is now convinced that Germany will be the only country to grow by more than 2% in 2011. This is Emma Alberici in London for AM.
The federal opposition leader, Tony Abbott, has stamped his authority on the coalition's workplace relations policy by ruling out a return to individual agreements. Mr. Abbott says he supports more flexibility in the workplace, but that won't extend to reinstating individual contracts like Australian workplace agreements. That's likely to disappoint business groups and members of Mr. Abbott's party. From Canberra, Naomi Woodley reports.
The federal government is quick to invoke the spectre of work choices and Australian workplace agreements whenever it's seeking to attack the opposition and its leader, Tony Abbott. Yesterday's question time was a case in point.
A recognition that there's one thing that he's actually in favour of. Of course, it's work choices, Mr. Speaker.
Order. This will be stripped away with the return to work choices.
They don't pull out the latest Back to the Future speech by Peter Reith and argue the case for, you guessed it, work choices.
The minister's attacks have been fuelled in recent weeks by the former Liberal Industrial Relations Minister Peter Reith calling for the opposition to do more to criticise the government's Fair Work system. But some current sitting coalition MPs are also arguing for a policy which includes statutory individual agreements. On the ABC's 7:30 program last night, Tony Abbott clearly ruled that out.
We don't support statutory individual contracts. We did once. We don't now.
Individual agreements were introduced by the Howard Coalition government in the mid-1990s, well before the introduction of the work choices system, which was largely part of that government's downfall at the 2007 election. Mr. Abbott's repeatedly declared work choices to be dead and buried. He says the government's Fair Work system is inflexible, but he's now setting limits on how far he'd be prepared to go to make changes in the future.
I think that there should be a community debate. I'm happy that there is a community debate. I think the debate should focus on practical problems with the government's legislation, not on the philosophy of workplace relations.
Business organisations like the Australian Industry Group and the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry have also been arguing for a return to individual agreements with an appropriate no disadvantage test. They argue it's an issue about productivity, and Mr. Abbott says he's sympathetic to their concerns.
We're happy to look at building more flexibility into the Fair Work Act. As Heather Ridout said the other day, the individual flexibility agreements under the Fair Work Act have promised so much, delivered so little, and I'll be looking forward to the kind of suggestions that people like Heather might have once they've spoken to their members.
He says the coalition will outline its full workplace relations policy well before the next election.
Naomi Woodley reporting. You're listening to AM Around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's 20 minutes past seven. Internationally, we're being heard on Radio Australia. And you can also follow us on Twitter. Just search for AM World Today PM. And the audio and transcripts of all of our stories can be found on our website. Just type ABC AM into your search engine. Japanese authorities have urged more than 1 million people to leave their homes for higher ground as a powerful typhoon bears down on one of the country's biggest cities. The storm has already triggered flooding and at least two deaths. North Asia correspondent Mark Willacy is in Tokyo. Mark, good morning. So where is this threat centred?
Well, Tony, the threat of this typhoon, Typhoon Rogue, is basically at the moment on Nagoya, which is one of the country's biggest cities. It's home to many millions of people. It's the centre of industry in Japan, the home of Toyota. And the typhoon is churning towards Nagoya. It's already caused some flooding in Nagoya. We understand that there are two people missing, a young boy and an old man. But the biggest problem is that there's going to be massive flooding, possibly caused by two rivers bursting their banks from this typhoon. The typhoon's dumping an incredible amount of rain. In fact, it dumped 1 metre of rain on one town in Kyushu. So with that amount of rain, the fear is that the two rivers that run in and around Nagoya will burst their banks. And so 1.3 million people nationwide have been asked to move to high ground. But in Nagoya, there are 1 million people who've been told to get out of their homes.
Japan has just been hit by a typhoon, and of course the country is regularly struck by these storms. What makes this one so different? Why is it causing so much concern?
Well, that last typhoon a couple of weeks ago hit western Japan, and it killed or left 100 people missing. That was quite a huge death toll, the biggest death toll in many years in Japan. But what it also did, it created massive lakes of water and mud up in the mountains of western Japan, and those lakes have been dammed by, you know, landslides and mud. And the fear is that this new typhoon will add to those lakes, those created lakes up in the mountains, and they could actually burst and come tumbling down the mountains and wash away entire villages and towns. So many people in western Japan have also been told to get out of their homes because of the fears that these lakes created by the last typhoon will be burst by this current typhoon.
Is there any suggestion that this latest typhoon could affect the stricken Fukushima plant?
There is. I'm just standing outside now. It is raining here in Tokyo. The rain is getting heavy, which means the typhoon is approaching here. It's moving northeast. And if it continues to move northeast, it will go past the Fukushima nuclear plant. Now, they have been frantically building covers for the damaged reactor buildings up there. They've, I believe, completed one cover, but two of the other reactor buildings are exposed. And the fear is that that rain could go tumbling into those reactor buildings and become basically irradiated. And then they've got all this extra radioactive water to get rid of. So that's a big problem for the operator of the Fukushima nuclear plant.
Our North Asia correspondent, Mark Willacy, in Tokyo. Members of the new Libyan government have been lauded at the United Nations and promised support to rebuild their country. Despite the National Transitional Council taking control, the former president, Muammar Gaddafi, is vowing to fight on, releasing an audio tape in which he warns rebels that NATO's protection won't last forever. North America correspondent Lisa Miller reports.
Libya's new flag is flying above the United Nations in New York this week as the country's new leaders take to the world stage.
This is a historic day.
This high-level conference attracted presidents and prime ministers and was designed to show Libyans the international support hasn't disappeared with the demise of Muammar Gaddafi.
And we've come here today to say to the people of Libya, just as the world stood by you in your struggle to be free, we will now stand with you in your struggle to realize the peace and prosperity that freedom can bring.
Barack Obama told the president of Libya's National Transitional Council that the US Embassy in Tripoli will reopen and new partnerships will be built. In response, Mustafa Abdel Jalil acknowledged there were still many challenges ahead after 8 months of fighting.
Our needs are many. We have lost 25,000 martyrs. There are double those numbers of wounded. There are many needs and requirements that necessitate extreme priority right away.
Some of those needs will be met by Australia, Foreign Minister Kevin Rudd adding his voice to the calls of support.
We will soon have the visit of an Australian delegation of senior officials, including our ambassador designate to Tripoli, and to explore ways in which we can provide further targeted and practical assistance in the new Libya, including an education reform, electoral assistance, and also the role of women in the new Libyan democracy.
Barack Obama also used this New York meeting to defend his strategy on Libya, having the US play a supporting rather than leading role.
This is how the international community should work in the 21st century. More nations bearing the responsibility and the costs of meeting global challenges.
But as Muammar Gaddafi's supporters cling on to one of the last strongholds in the former president's hometown of Sirte, the man himself is determined not to fade away. In an audio tape released as the UN meeting took place, he said his regime still lived and NATO's protection of the rebels wouldn't last forever. This is Lisa Miller in Washington for AM.
The United Nations is set to host one of its most historic sessions this week when the Palestinian leadership launches a bid for state membership in defiance of opposition from Israel and the US. Palestinians say they've given up on 20 years of negotiations and have the support of the vast majority of UN member nations. Even a partial win could give Palestinians greater powers to challenge Israel's control over Gaza and the West Bank. Middle East correspondent Anne Barker reports from Jerusalem.
Exactly 1 year ago this week, Barack Obama, in a speech to the United Nations, foreshadowed a day within 12 months when a new Palestinian state might seek membership of the UN.
When we come back here next year, we can have an agreement that will lead to a new member of the United Nations, an independent, sovereign state of Palestine living in peace with Israel.
That grand prediction coincided with the renewal of peace talks between Israel and Palestinian leaders that many had hoped, if only fleetingly, would produce a peace agreement inside a year based on a two-state solution. But after those talks quickly foundered, like all others before, the Palestinians decided to go to the UN anyway to seek recognition and full membership of a Palestinian state.
It's about time for the international community to take up in more direct way its responsibilities towards guaranteeing the Palestinian people the right of freedom and statehood.
Hassan Khatib is the media spokesman for the Palestinian government, whose president, Mahmoud Abbas, is today in New York to put the historic campaign for statehood to the United Nations.
Palestinian leaders are hoping to engage the international community in serious discussions about ways and means through which we can push this peace process forward, through which we can bring about an end to the Israeli occupation.
President Abbas will put the case for membership directly to the UN Security Council, but the US has already indicated it'll veto the plan. In that event, he'll instead apply to the UN General Assembly to upgrade the Palestinian status to that of a non-member observer, like the Vatican, which at the very least would give them stronger rights under international law to challenge Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. But Israel and the US, including Barack Obama himself, say any such move will only jeopardize the formal peace process. Mark Regev is the foreign media spokesman for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
At the very best, the United Nations can provide the Palestinians with a piece of paper. But peace and Palestinian statehood can only be the result of negotiations and a peace agreement with Israel.
There are also fears that the Palestinian campaign, whether it succeeds or not, could spark new violence on the ground. Already this week, violence has broken out between Palestinians and Jewish settlers in the West Bank. Mark Regev says the Israeli Prime Minister is offering to reopen talks with the Palestinian president in New York.
I would ask the Palestinians, have you indeed been serious about negotiations? Because had you been more serious about negotiations, maybe there could have been a historic Israeli-Palestinian peace treaty.
Both the Israeli Prime Minister and President Abbas will address the UN on Friday. This is Anne Barker in Jerusalem for AM.
And to the financial markets now, and in New York, the Dow Jones has closed at 11,409 points. That is up 8 points. The Nasdaq was down 23 points. In London, the FT 100 finished the day up 104 points. The dollar is buying 102.7 US cents, 78.4 Japanese yen, and just under 75 euro cents. Perhaps it was the IMF report, but spot gold has leapt up. And that's 7:30, and that's AM for today.